2,308. Right. Do I just sort of move up as slots become available, and it sort of is a line in a sense?
Basically, yes. And in that sense, it is sort of like getting your number at a deli counter. So for that diversity lottery, basically each year we have 55,000 visas, and they're allocated randomly to nationals from those countries that I said are more underrepresented. Unlike a real lottery, you can't buy 12 tickets. You get one, mm-hmm. and then you hope that you get your number called.
Let me ask you, in everything we've been talking about, the lines that sort of exist in some cases, the lottery, if you're from a country that is underrepresented, as you say, people who qualify under President Obama's action to have their deportation deferred, are they at some sort of advantage?
Not really. I mean, what you have essentially is a legal holding pattern. So they are not in a queue for legal admission by having this deferred action.
I think that the way I imagine some of the criticism here, the picture that some might paint, is that you have someone who is not deported because they were able to qualify under the president's plan. They're able to stay in the United States, and being here in the country would give them some sort of advantage over someone who is in Mexico, El Salvador, and is sort of waiting to be able to get a visa and start that path to citizenship.
Historically, that has been very true. And in fact, the way our policies have usually worked out in practice is the longer you have been in the United States, even in undocumented status, the stronger your claim to being able to stay. And so if one's looking at historical precedent, I think that's a fair assumption. But you just don't know how immigration reform is going to play out. It really depends on what's adopted in the future. If it's adopted in the future, we've been waiting a long time, whether one, in fact, has that sort of claim to legal immigration later.
Okay, so you're saying that in the past, people who were actually here on U.S. soil for a longer period of time might be at an advantage. But at the moment, we actually don't know if the people who fall under the president's plan will be at an advantage or not.
Correct. In terms of permanent legal status, getting a green card and being a legal permanent resident, it's all contingent on what Congress might do in the future.
Dan Tischner is the Knight Professor of Political Science at the University of Oregon. Professor, thanks so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
And one of the most controversial decisions a Western nation can make when faced with the kidnapping of its citizens by terrorists is whether to pay a ransom or allow a ransom to be paid. That's among the issues that will be addressed by the British government when it introduces sweeping new counterterrorism legislation tomorrow. From London, reporter Vicky Barker has the story.
The proposed legislation will give British authorities more power to confiscate the passports of anyone they suspect of planning to travel to join or return from Islamist forces in Iraq and Syria. It will require more detailed reporting from airlines, phone companies, and internet service providers. And British Home Secretary Theresa May said the government will also step up attempts to cut off a major source of funding for terror groups like the self-declared Islamic State.
The bill will amend existing law to make sure UK-based insurance firms do not provide cover for the payment of terrorist ransoms.
May cited UN estimates that ISIS has raised nearly $44 million from ransom payments in the past 12 months alone. It's already a criminal offense here in Britain to finance terrorism. The new law clarifies that the payment of ransoms falls into that category. London is a major hub for the global insurance industry, but it's not clear whether the law would have much effect beyond Britain's borders. The US and the UK are among the few Western governments that are on the record as refusing to ransom their citizens. Michael Winter is a Middle East expert at the Quilliam Foundation, a counterterrorism think tank. He says that in the absence of a Europe-wide ban on ransoms, ISIS leaders are almost certain to order more kidnappings.
The principal stream of income is from oil and gas, but as oil and gas is depleted by coalition airstrikes, there will be a rise in kidnapping for ransom if people do continue to pay money.
The new legislation is being launched in the middle of a week-long government campaign to educate members of the British public about the terror threat and to enlist their help. 3,000 police and security officers are visiting schools, shopping malls, airports, and cinemas, telling people how to spot if a friend or relative is being radicalized. Theresa May said about 5 terror plots have been foiled this year alone, 40 since the July 7 bombings in 2005. She also said 77 families have come forward in recent weeks to express fears that their children may have been radicalized. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
This is NPR News.
The spread of Ebola is changing in Liberia. What could that mean for the U.S. military? Troops have been building Ebola treatment units there.
The construction should scale down and take the amazing capacities that have been brought to bear here and direct them elsewhere.
That story, plus the latest from Ferguson, Missouri, later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good morning, I'm David Green. Sometimes it's called face control when a bouncer decides if you can get in based on what you look like. Well, a hotel in Sweden is trying out Facebook control. They'll let you stay for free if you have 2,000 friends on Facebook or 100,000 fans on Facebook or Instagram. Let me just ask our director here, Lindsay Toddy, how many Facebook fans does our program have?
About 300,000.
All right. Well, how do you feel about doing the show from Stockholm? It's Morning Edition.
Support for Morning Edition on KVNF comes from listeners and from Connect for Health Colorado, reminding listeners that if your current health insurance plan is up for renewal, December 15th is the deadline to avoid a gap in coverage. Health insurance guides are available to assist in choosing which health plan will best meet your health and budget needs. Information at connectforhealthco.com.
Good morning, I'm Patricia Naft. You're listening to Morning Edition on KVNF. It's 7:31. Amtrak is detoured around Glenwood Springs and six other stops until Wednesday. Union Pacific tracks were closed because of a rock slide about 7 miles west of Kremling. During the closure, Amtrak missed stops in Fraser, Granby, Glenwood Springs, Grand Junction, and Green River, Helper, and Provo. Passengers are being taken by charter buses to these missed destinations. And two deputies with the Mesa County Sheriff's Office arrested a Fruitvale man Sunday who they thought initially threatened them with a gun. The man was actually pointing a banana at them. 27-year-old Nathan Rolf Channing pointed a banana at the officers while crossing the 29th Road Bridge on foot. Channing's arrest affidavit yelled, "It's a banana." Channing told the deputies he is a stand-up comedian and was doing a trial run for a planned YouTube video, something he said he did often because he thought it would be funny. The sun rose at 7:03 this morning. The sun set tonight, 4:50 p.m. We have a beautiful sliver of a waxing crescent moon, 11% full. You're experiencing very short days, very dark outside. Next full moon, December 6th.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service working to help small businesses run efficiently and improve customer experience with features to stay connected from anywhere. Uma, the smartphone for your business. More at OOMA.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. In West Africa, medical experts have noticed a worrisome trend in the spread of Ebola. The virus is clustering in cities and then ping-ponging back out to rural areas. Health officials are struggling with how to stop Ebola in remote areas. NPR's Kelly McEvers recently went with a team of outbreak investigators tracking a case of Ebola deep in the Liberian jungle.
The day starts at 3 a.m. Drive 5 hours from the capital, then stop at a small rural clinic in central Liberia. When I say small rural clinic, I mean something more like a house with a few rooms and no electricity.
You understand, right?
Inside the clinic, the head nurse confirms what the team has already heard. There's a woman in the area who's rumored to have Ebola. The nurse shows one of the investigators a hand-drawn map of where we need to go to find that woman.
On our way to Fermaita?
From Turemu, you go to Fermaita.
Fermaita. It's the last village at the end of a thin black line on the map. A thin black line means the only way to get there is to walk. Down a long footpath into the hot, thick jungle, 4 hours each way. As we walk, I ask epidemiologist Mutawe Lubogo from the African Union if we know whether the woman has symptoms.
It's not clear whether she has symptoms or not, but any contact, you have to follow up for 21 days.
So what are the different ranges of responses that you could have for this person if she does in fact have symptoms?
As of now, the only thing we could do is to identify them early when they still have strength to walk.
If they're early enough, they could walk to the closest point where a vehicle could pick them up. So like the walking we're doing now, which is not easy, let me just say. You know, we just went over a bridge basically made out of sticks.
They are no.
I'm trying to imagine a patient going through this. That's
and
what I'm
especially
saying.
If it was a rainy season.
Right.
So.
And they were sick.
And when you're sick.
This is no good. Lubogo is from Uganda. He worked on the 2007 Ebola outbreak there.
You're talking to someone who has seen it before. All the difference is in Uganda, Ebola was confined to rural areas.
I mean, but now it seems like the issue in Liberia is that it is becoming rural again.
If I fall sick, I have to come to the rural area where I have my parents, my relatives to give me care.
This is how ping-ponging works. People go back and forth between the city, where there's commerce, and the village, where there's family. And a few of them take Ebola with them. Out here, a village is basically a clearing in the jungle. 10 or 20 huts with walls of mud and roofs of branches and leaves. Each village has a well, a fire pit for cooking, and small fields nearby to grow food. Each village is about an hour from the next one. At the fourth one, we find a clue. The team finds a man who people say is a traditional healer. He supposedly cared for the woman who people think has Ebola and for other people with Ebola. The team lists off the names of people who've tested positive for Ebola.
Yeah, I know Siawali.
You knew Siawali?
Yes.
The man says he knows a lot of these people. He denies that he's a healer. He won't even admit that he's touched or treated any of them. This is called contact tracing. If you're doing it in Dallas, you get addresses and phone numbers. Out here, it's different. We leave the man and keep on walking. We finally make it to the village where the woman's supposed to be. So here we are. Whew. We have been walking for 4 hours. Yeah, gone through five villages, heard all kinds of rumors. Now we're gonna see what's going on, see if she's here, see if she's sick, and what kind of treatment can be given to her, if any. The village is pretty quiet. Some laundry drying in the sun. People are gathered around the team. It's always kind of sensitive. People hold up their hands as if they're being accused of something. Then they all talk at once. The group is standing in front of a wooden door to a hut where the woman stays. The door is closed. No one is opening the door. I walk off to the side. So they say the woman is gone. We'll find out more details later, but all this way to find somebody who maybe was sick and she's not even here, or if she is, she's in hiding.
Maybe behind that door. Or worse, she's dying somewhere in the jungle or already dead. If either of those last things are true, she is very contagious. Whatever it is, most of the outbreak investigation team thinks the people in the village are hiding something. Here's county health official Emmanuel Due talking to them.
If what you're telling us is true, then true. But I will not advise you to keep sick poison to your place. If you wait until the poison dies, then you kill that poison. And you understand me clearly?
We understand, they say. At this point, there's not much more the team can do. And now, we're going back out. Back down the road.
4 more hours back out of the jungle. On the way, we pick up the man, who's thought to be the traditional healer who treated and touched people with Ebola. He's agreed to come with us. We have to make the monkey bridge by dark, Emmanuel Due keeps saying. That's the last bridge, the biggest bridge. It's two bamboo poles over a dark, muddy river. The plan, once we get to the clinic, is to have an ambulance take the alleged traditional healer to a stadium where they monitor people who might have Ebola. If he's okay after 21 days, he'll be let go. But that night, the road to the clinic goes out, and the ambulance can't reach him. the man who might have Ebola, goes back to his village. This is why it's so difficult to stop Ebola. These places are very hard to reach. The roads are bad, there's no electricity, no phone coverage. And once you finally get to where you're going, you have no idea what you're going to find. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Monrovia.
And we have a way for you to get a vivid picture from Kelly's story. You can see pictures of the Monkey Bridge and other pictures at our Goats and Soda blog at NPR.org. And we should say NPR producer Rebecca Hersher contributed to that story. This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on KVNF. Good morning, I'm Patricia Naft. Sunlight Mountain Resort joins the growing list of ski areas opening early. The adequate early season snowfall will allow Sunlight Mountain Resort to open a week earlier than planned. All three lifts and 60% of the skiable terrain will be open. Sunlight Resort is located about 10 miles south of Glenwood Springs. And Ski Cooper off of U.S. Highway 24 near Leadville is also set to open on Friday. But tomorrow, head on over to Crested Butte, where they're offering free skiing on their opening day, November 26th. It's 20 degrees in Paonia, Hotchkiss, 21 in Crawford and Cedar Edge, 20 in Delta and Montrose, 25 degrees in Grand Junction. The news is next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Things are quieter this morning in Ferguson, Missouri. Last night, angry protesters set at least a dozen businesses on fire and smashed storefront windows after a grand jury decided not to indict Darren Wilson for the August shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown. More than 60 people were arrested in Ferguson, another 20-plus in St. Louis.
Violence doesn't solve anything, and if we're going to have real change in this community, it's going to take all of us working together and not committing violence.
That's St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay. The University of Virginia's Board of Visitors is meeting today to look at how the school handles allegations of sexual assault. It follows a female student's account in Rolling Stone magazine of being gang-raped by seven men in a fraternity. For now, UVA is suspending all fraternity activities.
The temporary suspension of fraternities gives our community a time to breathe and to develop more substantive and actionable changes that confront this complicated problem in the long term.
That's Tommy Reed, president of UVA's Interfraternity Council. The U.S. economy grew at a clip of 3.9% during the third quarter, stronger than first estimated by the Commerce Department. On Wall Street, stocks are higher in early trading. The Dow is up 14 points, the S&P up 2. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
KVNF's holiday auction is right around the corner. Join in the fun. December 8th through the 12th. Visit kvnf.org today and click the auction link to place your pre-bid on hundreds of exciting items. Or call us at 527-4866 to sign up for a bidder number and place a pre-bid. Here's your chance to get a great deal on holiday gifts and support your community radio station.
Coming up on the regional newscast at 8, a recap of the championship football game. Colorado will deliberate on assisted suicide and the arrest made in the Paige Bergfield case. Followed by Ashley in the Tuesday Morning Music Mix. Hot cooking oil sparked a fire Sunday that charred the kitchen and attic insulation of a Montrose home. Montrose Fire Protection District responded to a turkey fire at 9 p.m. Sunday night. It turned out that the home's resident had been heating oil on the stove in order to make French fries. But when he stepped outside to check on his dog, the oil ignited, catching the kitchen cabinets and traveling through the electric ceiling vent into the attic. Stay tuned for Morning Edition coming up next.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, Northeast farm families who make cheddar cheese, and award volunteers for their commitment at rewardvolunteers.com. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. And from the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Last night, Ferguson, Missouri erupted into its worst rioting since the summer. Buildings were burned, stores looted, and automatic gunfire erupted throughout the night.
All of this was angry reaction to the grand jury's decision not to indict a white police officer in the shooting death last August of a young black man named Michael Brown. All this violence despite a late-night televised plea for calm from President Obama.
There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully.
We will continue following this story throughout the show, but let's turn now to Cleveland, where there were peaceful protests yesterday over the police shooting at a playground that left an adolescent African-American boy dead. As Nick Castell of member station WCPN reports, authorities are promising an investigation.
On Saturday afternoon, 12-year-old Tamir Rice went with some friends to a park on Cleveland's west side. He was carrying an air pistol that fires plastic pellets. Soon after, someone at the park called 911, reporting a juvenile with what seemed to be a pistol, adding he thought the gun was probably fake. Police say responding officers told Rice to raise his hands, but that he instead reached toward the air gun tucked into his waistband. One officer standing about 10 feet away shot twice, hitting Rice in the abdomen. He later died at a hospital. In a news conference yesterday, Cleveland Police Chief Calvin Williams offered his condolences to the family.
I have nieces and nephews around the same age as this young man. And I'm sure I know that my family would also be heartbroken.
Williams declined to name the officer who shot Rice, but said he's broken up over it.
There is no time that a Cleveland police officer wants to go out and shoot a kid, period. And that's the way that officer feels.
Police say they've shown a family representative a surveillance video that depicts what happened in the park on Saturday. It's not the first death involving police to touch a nerve in Cleveland. A woman with mental illness died earlier this year as police were taking her into custody. And 2 years ago, an extended car chase ended with multiple officers firing more than 100 shots, killing the driver and the passenger.
No peace! Don't shoot!
Last night, protesters marched peacefully through the neighborhood where Tamir Rice lived. As they passed neighbor Jessica Vison's, she waved in support. Vison says she doesn't think kids should have realistic toy guns, but she's quick to add that she doesn't think that justifies the police response.
He could have handled that in a whole nother way. They're trained to do this. They're not trained to right away kill. You could have handled it in a whole nother way, especially when a young man did nothing.
At the park where Rice was killed, about 100 protesters collected money to help his family pay for their son's funeral. Later, they encircled the family and prayed for them. Nicole Jameson came to this rally with her 10-year-old son. She says on one hand, she understands that officers were trying to protect themselves.
But they also could have handled the situation differently. I don't think the outcome had to be death. I don't think he had to die. He's 12 years old.
The head of Cleveland's police union says the officers involved didn't know that the gun Rice was holding was fake. At question will be whether that information was relayed to the officers from the 911 call. After a 90-day investigation, police will turn the case over to the county prosecutor, who says he'll present it to a grand jury that will decide whether to charge the officer with a crime. For NPR News, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Silvia Poldroli. In Italy, we treat our cars like family. They stand by us and give us years of loyal service, no matter how many Roman relics we sideswipe. So when it's time to say ciao bella to your old car, donate it to us. You'll get a tax break and we'll tow it away free. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car to KVNF. For more details, go to kvnf.org.
Good morning, I'm Patricia Naft. You're listening to Morning Edition on KVNF. It's 10 till 8. State champions in high school 1A football, the Paonia Eagles, will be honored tonight in Paonia with a victory parade. The parade will take place on Grand Avenue in Paonia at 5:30 p.m. tonight. That's Tuesday, November 25th. And also today, crews will implement a full closure of U.S. Highway 50, both eastbound and westbound, at mile marker 107 in order to remove an irrigation pipe that spans the highway. The highway is going to be closed from 10 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. The alternate route is over the Black Canyon Road, State Highway 92 to Hotchkiss. Stay tuned for Morning Edition coming up next. It's 21 degrees in Montrose, 26 in Grand Junction, 19 in Ouray, 21 in Naderita and Nucla, 20 in Norwood, 8 degrees in Telluride, 14 in Mountain Village, and 7 degrees in Lake City.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. Thanksgiving week seems like a good time to think about how our nation came to be, to remember the people who were on this land first and the people who came to explore it. We're taking a journey back in time, of sorts, across an ocean and a continent. It starts with a mythical prince, and it ends with Easy Rider. Oh yeah, and there are a few unicorns in between. Our guide is this singer-songwriter and amateur historian. His name is Griff Rees. He's from Wales. His first language, Welsh, has long been threatened since Wales is but a small corner of an English-speaking nation. Griff is in a Welsh rock band called Super Furry Animals, but he's out with a new solo album called American Interior. It is all about the adventure his Welsh ancestor went on in America in the 18th century.
I used to be told a story when I was growing up about this incredible character who left a very ordinary existence in Wales to do something extraordinary.
That ancestor, John Evans, he was a Welsh farm boy who bought into a legend that somewhere across the Atlantic Ocean, there was a tribe of American Indians who, get this, spoke Welsh.
An expedition was proposed in Wales to find this tribe, befriend them, and then start a new Wales in the new world.
It was a time when kings and queens all over Europe were obsessed with making their claims on America. And the word in Wales was that this tribe was there, supposedly descendants of a mythical Welsh prince who got to America a few centuries before Christopher Columbus. So our guide, Griff Rees, is going to take us to America on the route his ancestor took over 200 years ago.
He set foot in America one fine October day. Sailing into Baltimore, well, everything's okay.
Griff Rees recounts that John Evans landed on the East Coast and then made his way to the frontier near where the Ohio River meets the Mississippi.
Everything west of the Mississippi at the time was under the jurisdiction of the Spanish king, and he defected to Spain, and at this point he becomes Don Juan Evans.
He's now a Spanish citizen in New Spain, Don Juan Evans.
Yeah, so I see him as a kind of David Bowie kind of figure, going through a series of transformations in his early 20s. You know, he reinvents himself. Unfortunately for him, within 10 days of being Don Juan, he contracted malaria.
Oh no. Does he recover?
Well, in his malarial hallucination, he decides to walk 2,000 miles to the north.
Don Don Juan Evans was heading north because he had heard about a tribe in what is now North Dakota, the Mandan people, who used boats similar to the Welsh.
The Welsh coracle, which is a leather-bound boat for one.
But before Evans got too far, he had a run-in with the French.
They didn't believe his story. They suspected him of being a spy.
A suspected U.S. spy. That landed Evans in a dungeon. He did eventually get out, and he joined a Spanish expedition up the Missouri River. And here's the thing. When you're an explorer working for the Spanish, your own agenda takes second fiddle. Griff Rees says Evans' new Spanish bosses had their own leads to follow.
There was also believed to be a herd of unicorn in the Rocky Mountains.
Unicorns in the Rockies, okay.
And he was asked to capture a specimen and bring it back alive. Another instruction was, should John Evans see any British forts in Spanish territory, he should try and retake these forts.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, they also asked him, you know, if he can find the Pacific Ocean, that would be really fantastic.
Just throw that in as well. If you come across the Pacific, let us know.
By September 1796, he'd reached the Mandan Nation. These were great cultures who practiced incredible ceremonies like the buffalo dance, and he would have witnessed incredible things for someone from the North Wales Mountains.
And this is very important because this is the tribe that he thought might be the descendants of the mythical prince and actually be the Welsh speakers.
Exactly. And after 9 months at the Mandan Nation, he came to the conclusion that they were not Welsh in any way. You know, it had been his lifetime passion, and he'd been walking for 5 years, more or less.
I can see this being a little disappointing.
It's documented at the time that he died of a broken heart at 29, and he was likely buried in the cemetery where they shot the LSD scene in the film Easy Rider.
Okay.
We're all aglow, man. Look at this. We're all aglow. Look.
Some kind of silver lining, you know.
Another silver lining John Evans did not see in his lifetime, his maps of the Missouri River would be used by Lewis and Clark, all of which always fascinated Griff Rees, who wanted to retrace his ancestors' footsteps on what he calls an investigative concert tour.
I'm trying to write new songs. I'm a songwriter. As you can see, I'm not a historian. But this is a song about John Evans being all alone in the American interior, maybe missing home.
And on his own journey, Griff Rees discovered something powerful. While the Welsh and the Mandan don't share a language, never did, they do have something in common. Each are fighting to protect a heritage. Welsh has historically been an endangered language. As for the Mandan tribe in the United States, today they are down to one native speaker. His name is Edwin Benson. He's in his 80s, and Griff Rees got to meet him.
It was extremely sad to find that 200 years after John Evans's journey, the Mandan culture had been repressed to an extent where there was only one speaker left. On the other hand, it was very inspiring getting to meet the young people who are very optimistic about the future, you know, and who are actively revitalizing the language through education and history.
Well, Griff Rees, this has been really, really enjoyable talking to you. I learned a lot about history, a lot about music, a lot about a story that I'd never heard. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Huge thanks. Thanks for talking to me. And it's a story I'll never tire of telling.
That's the Welsh singer-songwriter Griff Rees. His new multimedia project is called American Interior. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Support for Morning Edition on KVNF comes from Ridgeway Mountain Market and the Market at Mountain Village, purveyors of fresh meats, fruits, vegetables, and dairy products, health and beauty items, and a full deli offering freshly prepared breakfast, lunch, and dinner options. Open 7 days a week from 7 a.m. until 9 p.m. More information at 970-626-5811 or at mountaingrocery.com.
Thank you.
This is Mountain Grown Public Radio for Western Colorado.
It's 8 o'clock. This is KBNF Regional News for Tuesday, November 25th. I'm Patricia Naft. Football fans packed into Paonia Town Park last weekend for the Division 1A championship. KBNF DJ Paul Gibb tells us how it all went down.
The Paonia Eagles made history on Saturday, capturing their second consecutive Colorado 1A state football championship. Led by a suffocating team defense and the usual brilliant play of junior Taylor Walters, the Eagles bested the visiting Buena Vista Demons by a score of 21-7. The Eagles jumped to an early 14-0 lead in the first quarter on a 2-yard touchdown run by Jeremiah Hillman. Followed by a sensational 60-yard over-the-shoulder touchdown reception by Logan Schopp on a pass from Walters. It was back and forth for the next two quarters plus, as neither team scored until Walters took it in from 2 yards out midway through the fourth quarter to seemingly put the game away. But the pesky Demons wouldn't go away quietly as they finally scored a touchdown late and then proceeded to recover an onside kick with plenty of time left to make things interesting. The Demons drove to the 1 yard line where, in a questionable coaching decision on fourth down, they tried to run it up the gut into the heart of the Paonia defense. Josh Kimball, backed by his linemates, drove to keep the Demons QB back to seal the victory. It was the second goal line stand of the day and embodied the mental and physical toughness this team has shown all year.
The 2014 Class 1A 11-man state football champions, your Paonia
The town of Paonia will surely savor its first back-to-back football chance for some time, although the talk of a three-peat is already starting to surface. The team loses numerous key seniors, including most of the offensive and defensive lines, but with Walters and several other major contributors returning next season, Coach Brent McCray and his staff will be back for another run. We'll see you next September.
The state champion Eagles will be honored tonight with a victory parade at 5:30 p.m. on Grand Avenue in Paonia. Colorado is one of several states that will take up the issue of physician-assisted suicide. The topic is once again in the national spotlight with the recent death of Brittany Maynard. The terminally ill 29-year-old moved to Oregon to take advantage of that state's death with dignity law. From the state capitol, Benta Berkland has more.
Oregon voters were the first in the country to pass the Death with Dignity Act. And now, two decades later, about 750 people have taken medication to hasten their deaths, including Brittany Maynard. She explained her decision to CBS News and says she doesn't view it as suicide because cancer is taking her life.
I am choosing to end it a little sooner and in a lot less pain and suffering.
But Peg Sandine says cases such as Maynard's are in the minority.
It's very rarely used.
Sandine heads the Death with Dignity National Center based in Portland, Oregon, which helped pass the initiative. She says there are safeguards in place. A patient must make 3 separate requests to medical officials and go through 2 waiting periods.
Then the person has to be evaluated by 2 different physicians, and both physicians have to determine that the person is terminally ill with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and also that the person is mentally competent to make health care decisions.
It's a model that Democratic Representative Lois Cort of Denver hopes Colorado can emulate.
I've gotten emails and phone calls from all over the state
from people who want the dignity of making this final decision.
Court is using one of her constituents as inspiration for a bill she plans to introduce during the next legislative session.
And he had ALS and he was suffering and he was starting to starve himself to death because he knew he was going to die.
Court was also moved by her own mother's decade-long battle and death from lung disease.
I said to my father, I want to see her. And my father said, no, you don't. You want to remember the mother you had, not what she has deteriorated into.
But the bill will be controversial and face an uphill battle with Republicans in control of the state Senate, where opposition is already building.
There is a significant moral responsibility government has to defend life and to preserve life, and a very dangerous slippery slope when we start dabbling in the, okay, but you can end a life here and you can end a life there.
That's Republican Senator Kevin Lundberg of Berthoud, who will chair the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. He says the proposal forces physicians to violate the oath of do no harm.
This promotes a notion that it's better to be dead. And I don't believe we as humans have that moral authority. I don't want to call it a whim, but on just the basis of this is not something I want to continue to do.
While some individual physicians support the process, the American Medical Association has long opposed physician-assisted suicide. But Peg Sandin with the Death with Dignity National Center says most of the opposition stems from religious objections.
In all of the political campaigns that we have been involved with, about 50% or 60% of the funding from the opposition campaign comes directly from the Catholic Church.
In 2012, the Catholic Church helped defeat a Death with Dignity ballot proposal in Massachusetts. Religious leaders from the Jewish community and other Christian denominations also opposed it. Washington State, Vermont, and Oregon are the only three states in the country with Death with Dignity laws on the books. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
A homicide that caught national attention 7 years ago has a big development. KVNF's Jake Ryan has more.
After years of investigation, an arrest has been made in the case of Paige Bergfeld, a Grand Junction woman who was murdered in 2007. This is Matt Lewis with the Mesa County Sheriff's Department.
On July 1st of 2007, Paige's car was found in a lot and it had been set on fire. It was burning. The investigation into her disappearance and background revealed that she had been working as an escort, running an escort service. So there was some time taken to kind of unravel a part of her life that she tried very hard to keep hidden. That case has been with us since 2007, and we've continued to work it, never forgetting about Paige and trying to bring this to a successful prosecution and hold someone accountable for this.
They recently arrested Lester Jones. Lewis says that they've been working on eliminating other subjects and gathering what evidence they can.
This case is by no means an easy case. This is going to be a difficult prosecution. But from the very beginning, we have believed that Lester Jones is responsible for the disappearance and subsequent murder of Paige Bergfeld.
Paige went missing in 2007, but her body was found in Delta County in 2012. For KVNF, I'm Jake Ryan.
Lester Jones' bail has been set at $2 million cash only. Up next, Ashley and the Tuesday Morning Music Mix. For KVNF News, I'm Patricia Naft.